Welcome back, everyone. This is the OIS Retina Podcast again. This is Firas Rahal. I'm a partner here in Los Angeles at the Retina Vitreous Associates and also a general partner at Excite Ventures out of New York City. And I'm really pleased to have as my guest today, Natasha Jovic. She is the Vice President of Marketing and Commercial Operations at RetinAI. And she just told me how to pronounce RetinAI, so I think I got it right. Natasha, thank you so much for agreeing to join us and taking time to come on.
Oh, thanks for us. A pleasure to be here.
Join Drs. Maria Barakal, Praveen Dugal, and Firas Rahal at the upcoming OIS Retina on July 27th in Seattle, where you'll see and meet with leading startup companies, top industry executives, and clinical thought leaders addressing unmet retina needs through novel therapies. Take advantage of the early bird registration or save 30% when you register for both OIS Retina and OIS 13, the original Ophthalmology Innovation Summit, taking place this December 1st and 2nd in San Diego. Register today at OIS.net.
I always start with my guest's personal background because I find that to be among the most interesting sometimes, just to hear how people got to where they are and what it is they did that led to that. So I saw in your background in education, I don't know if you're from British Columbia, maybe you'll tell us, but you went to Simon Fraser University and got a bachelor's and an MBA. Why don't we start with your educational background and then maybe tell us while you were there studying, is this what you ended up, did you think this is where you would be going in your career, healthcare, life sciences, et cetera?
Right. Yeah, no. Actually, not born in Canada. I was born in Belgium, but my parents immigrated to Canada. I think it was like the mid 70s. So I was just a couple years old at the time, and certainly more raised in Vancouver, the west coast of Canada. And so I went to the University of British Columbia doing a bachelor's in science. I've always had an interest in the scientific field. I think initially I wanted to pursue veterinary medicine and move there. And instead, actually, I ended up shortly after getting my bachelor's in science, I ended up at QLT, as you know, was the manufacturer of Visudyne, the first treatment for age-related macular degeneration, the wet form. And then during the course of my career at QLT, when I was a product manager, that's when I pursued my master's in business administration through Simon Fraser University. So I was really lucky to have a few good mentors on the commercial side in marketing at QLT. And I think that propelled me to sort of marry the scientific base with the business knowledge as well. So that's how I ended up pursuing an MBA. And I think QLT was a really cool company to initially work with because we were Canadian, but we did have this major agreement with Novartis to co-promote, or actually Novartis ended up promoting Visudyne. We manufactured it, but it gave me exposure to ophthalmology, to retina specifically, and more of a global outlook too, because it was the first therapy for wet AMD.
Yeah, QLT, well known to those of us like myself who practiced a long time. I was in the VAM study in 1998-99 when I was in New York at Cornell. I thought it was just super cool technology, the whole idea. I still use it. There, some retina practices don't even have the lasers anymore. We do, and we get some referrals from other retina doctors to treat central serous chorioretinopathy and other things. It's even still useful, not commonly, but occasionally in wet AMD as an adjunct, and definitely in something we treat a lot of here in Los Angeles called polypoidal choroidal vasculopathy. It's pretty useful, and it's still a great product. I believed in it then, and in the early days, this was really a landmark moment. It was really the first treatment. People forget it. It wasn't Macugen that was the first treatment. And Dave Boyer, my partner here, and I used to do a lot of PDT plus intravitreal Kenalog as an excellent treatment for wet AMD. You obviously during that time got to know the retina space, a fairly unique and small space in medicine. Is that how you ended up deciding this is a good area for you? Was it happenstance, or did you like the space then and that motivated you to want to be in the retina space again later?
Yeah, I definitely enjoyed the retina space. I think I found it very interesting in terms of the innovations that were coming to the market at the time, certainly with PDT, the imaging innovation, and then also with the intravitreal injections that came late 2005, 2006. So I always found it to be a relatively small community, but a lot of changes going on in that space. So it attracted me right from the beginning. I did have, during the course of my time at QLT, because we weren't a commercial company per se, we did have this agreement with Novartis where they were marketing Visudyne. I was working on a lot of things in development that included other ophthalmology opportunities, as well as developments we were doing along photodynamic therapy in urology, dermatology, and the oncology space. So it was actually nice to have a little bit of exposure to those other areas too, but I just always had a desire and attraction to go back to retina.
Yeah, I've had this conversation with colleagues, with other members on the industry side. Even though it's a very small specialty in terms of numbers of doctors, it's kind of boutique. It's always been a pretty entrepreneurial space and very innovative, and retina doctors almost universally adopt a new innovation and new technology quickly, many times off-label, you know, non-FDA approved. Avastin story is unbelievable. Within months, it was being injected millionfold all over the world. It's a really great story. And there's others similar, maybe not quite as with the same magnitude. So that brings us kind of to the current. You're in a brand new space of technology under the rubric of AI. I'm going to ask you to help us with this in a minute. It's definitely talked about a lot in the retina space. It's talked about all over life sciences and non-life sciences, manufacturing, et cetera. Can you start by talking to a simple person like me and telling me, how do you define AI and or machine learning within AI? Is it a component? Are these separate things? I'm not a technology wizard. It'll help me to understand where you guys sit on this.
Right. Yeah, I'm not a technology wizard either. But the way I look at it is, and I think the way it's been sort of broadly defined is AI is the broad area of science, you know, sort of disciplines of computer science that looks at developing machines or models to do human functions. So whether that's data analysis, decision making, you know, et cetera. So that's kind of AI is the broad field. Machine learning is a subset of artificial intelligence that looks at basically the machine or the model ingesting large amounts of data to improve the accuracy by which the analysis is made or by which decisions are made. And then even beyond that, there's deep learning, which is a subset of machine learning that looks at AI having artificial neural networks. So much like our neural network to make decisions, the model or the machine actually has artificial neural networks to come to a conclusion without human intervention. So AI in general, there's human oversight, machine learning in general, there's human oversight, and then deep learning strives to kind of take the human component out of that. But that's the way I broadly understood those categories.
That's very good. Actually, that was really helpful. And I'm glad you brought in deep learning because I wouldn't have known how to define that. That's very useful. And it brings to mind, I was going to ask you about this anyway. I'm glad you brought it up. We're now at a point, it seems, and it falls under deep learning from my understanding of what you just explained, that the machines, the artificial intelligence can now ask themselves the question. And what comes to mind is this recent story I heard in a presentation of how I think it was Google, the machine learning system figured out that female pigment in the macula is distinctly a little different than male pigment in the macula. And it was apparently a question on fundus photography.
Right.
And it was apparently not a question that was asked by us humans of the machine. And it maybe through these tens or hundreds of thousands of fundus photography images figured out that that was a question we might want to ask. Is that a fair understanding of what deep learning can do?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that's a fair understanding. I mean, that's quite interesting. I hadn't heard that, but
yeah, it came out last year, I think.
That's very interesting. I think the ability to anticipate the key questions and then, of course, you know, arrive to a conclusion, arrive to a decision, that's the deep learning aspect of and a subset of machine learning, and of course a subset in and of itself of artificial intelligence. So
this is the part that scares people a little, which I won't digress into now. We won't make it a political show. But if you have comments later about that, I'm happy to hear them. With regard to the retina then, or ophthalmology in general, right up your alley and mine, of course, we are an industry, a medical field that's definitely reliant on technology now. We're heavily image-based. Imaging is everything to us. OCT, fundus photography, I just referred to. Does this make our space a perfect milieu for AI to be an early entrant in the health sciences?
Definitely. The amount of data that's being generated, I think one of the publications I remember reading, and it was a little bit dated, it was back in 2015, but I think there was something like 30 million OCTs that are generated globally each year. And I'm sure that number is increasing significantly. And even in terms of the number of publications in this space around OCTs and ophthalmology, I think from the very first publication in the early 1990s to, you know, more than 3,000 publications that we have to date around OCTs and ophthalmology. So it is a perfect place to start. I think we're data rich across the board in healthcare, but particularly in retina, where there's a lot of imaging going on. And I think there's a real opportunity to be more data driven in how we take that data, how we digest it, and make conclusions that can either assist, you know, management and treatment of patients, not necessarily autonomously, you know, get to the point where, you know, it's a definitive diagnosis, a definitive treatment, but help assist the clinical decision-making around a patient.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I definitely want to get into that in a minute. We're definitely going to talk about that. That seems to be the most fascinating or practically important part of this. Before we get into that, just for context, so I understand, or the audience understands, what makes a field particularly amenable for this. You've been in other health science sectors. What came to mind to me is things like pathology, where slides are read, or radiology, where it's really image-based. Are these other areas, and are there others that come to mind for you that might be big for entry of AI and machine learning?
Yeah, definitely. And I know, I think as of January 2023, the FDA approved over 500 AI algorithms across the healthcare field. And radiology by far is has the most approvals. I think 75% of the approvals are attributed to applications in radiology, with the majority of that being around cancer screening and cancer management. Next is sort of cardiology, but there's hematology, there's dentistry, there's ophthalmology. I think we've got 7 approved AI technologies in that space. So we're not down at the bottom, but, you know, there's certainly, you know, a lot more in the radiology space. And pathology too. It's around where ophthalmology is, with about 4 or 5 approvals in the AI space. But yeah, it seems to be touching every aspect of healthcare across these different, you know, disease areas and therapeutic focus. Which is good, which is encouraging. And I think it's giving us, you know, more guidance from the FDA aspect, how these trials should be run, you know, how they're regulated, how improvements, you know, to these algorithms are made and, you know, subsequent approvals through regulators. So I think it's good to have kind of AI sort of touching broadly across these different areas.
I think that's amazing. And I didn't know there are that many hundreds of approvals. As an aside to that, that it's a whole another discussion and show, so I won't waste all your time on it, but I'm intrigued by the approval process here. Is the regulatory pathway for an AI software program or device the same as a routine 510K like device approval, or are there specific differences there?
Yeah, it really depends. If there's a predicate on the market, and for instance, this could be measuring retinal layer thickness. So there's predicates on the market for that. That would be like a 510K path for your software to be approved as a medical device. In the case of fluid quantification, that would be different. That would be a de novo application that you would make. So, and then the bar obviously increases as you look at clinical decision support tools. And I think one of the, you know, interesting things from my perspective is to see how the regulators, how the FDA in particular, will look at, you know, what's been used to validate the model, or what's been used to develop the model, I should say, train the model, and then ultimately what's used to validate the model. And I think it's going to be a mixture of both taking really good data sets from real world data, you know, across a number of different patient cohorts, but ultimately, you know, the approval will lie with a prospective study to obviously prove outcomes, and whether that is related to endpoints for treatment improvement or endpoint that the quantification, you know, has the same level of accuracy as a human grade or human oversight to look at that. So I think that's where I wouldn't say the challenge lies, but just how these software as a medical devices will be treated in terms of how they're studied in the context of development, training, and then of course, model validation for clinical use.
That's very clear, and really, a great explanation of the process. It's tricky to understand how devices get approved anyway, and I have some knowledge in this, but the software space becomes a whole different arena, and I think even the FDA is going to have to evolve their notion of how to approve these products, is my guess. That was a very clear explanation. Let's talk about some of the potential places it would have a role, and I'm going to start quite simplistically with a fairly mundane question. I'm aware of some software programs, not necessarily from you, but many companies are looking at this, mostly startups, right, of improving the, let's say, efficiency, the streamlining of decision-making around intravitreal injections, one of the most common medical procedures in the world, where I do 6,000 or 7,000 a year. We're all doing thousands of these. Simple specialist like me, I walk in the room, the OCT's projected, and it's like a 2-second decision most of the time. That's how we get through all these patients. Where do you see the value add specifically? And I don't mean like, you don't have to be too granular, but in this kind of decision-making process, you know, streamlining the intravitreal injection process or decision or whatever you think would be where value add would come in.
Right. Yeah, it's a really good question. I think one, you know, even that we face when we talk to clinics and clinicians, I think it's going to come down to improving outcomes with the improvement in cost. So whether that's the utilization of those therapies, so looking at large databases and maybe, you know, the cost utilization is better spent on, you know, those individuals remaining on Avastin, even if these markers, you know, demonstrate this, because long-term outcomes show that those patients will continue to do well. So that's a better cost utilization for that therapy versus, you know, the branded therapies in the case of neovascular AMD. So I think it's going to be kind of a two-pronged approach to the improvement of outcomes and the better utilization of treatment. I don't think it's necessarily going to be driven of, you know, saving 30 seconds by, you know, looking at the OCT and saying, okay, well, that fluid went up, fluid went down, right? Until we get into a situation where now we're looking at the history of the patient and we're trying to sort of digest all those data points around that patient and make some sense to kind of the trends and you know, what we're seeing based on the dynamics around fluid and what the outcome was. I think that's a little bit harder to do from the time that we have to spend with patients or clinicians have to spend with patients. So I think looking at historical data for not all patients, I would say, but for a subset of patients where it may be difficult to kind of get to the right treatment regimen. I think that's where AI plays a role. But again, I think it's the improvement of outcomes and reducing costs at the same time.
Yeah, that's brilliant. I love the discussion on reducing costs because that seems to be an area that we really need help with. And not because we're wasting money, but right. This has become a pretty expensive area. And I think there's no way for any one or small group of clinicians to have enough raw data in their mind to be able to do a real cost analysis. This seems a great place for AI. And I think some people will be disappointed with the answers, which I think will help society overall, exactly right. In the example you gave. And there are a million other examples. But I also agree that even despite my mundane comment about the reading of the OCT, and I appreciate you acknowledging that, there is a lot of recency bias for a clinician. And, oh yeah, you know, the last few months, this is what's been happening. But if you really look at the 10-year history of the patient and can process that across aggregates of patients, it would improve decision-making, no doubt. It would streamline it, yes, but it would actually improve it. You would know better when to treat the patient and when you could be, say, more fluid tolerant. There are patients who do very well for long periods of time with small amounts of fluid who may not need treatment. We all know this clinically, but we're all sort of petrified by the absence of proof to do various things. This would give us proof and might save money and time for patients as well.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it's a great point. And I think this is the move or where clinical studies are going to is the criteria for enrollment are becoming more and more narrow in terms of the certain thresholds around fluid, thresholds around thickness, you know, other biomarkers that may kind of accompany, you know, the disease itself. So I think as we sort of move more and more upstream to, you know, what the phenotype, I guess, of that disease is and enrolling that right patient into those clinical trials, I think that's what's fueling this move to look at that data in a more detailed way, a more enhanced way, and getting down to a much more narrow criteria for enrolling patients. So
that's a great segue. I wanted to ask you about, you're on it, man. I wanted to ask you about drug development and the application of these technologies. It seems to me that's the more current world we're in right now. I'm aware of a program at Dompé. They're my friends. They've also been on this program. Gianluca Rossetti's a good friend of mine. They have a program in early drug development, product development that they're applying AI. I'm sure there are other big pharmas who are applying this, maybe all of them. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about that currently. Is this the new way we're going to discover drugs? Is this the only way now? Can we ever go back to not having AI as a part of drug or product development?
I think we need it. I think the kind of current timelines around drug development and the amount of cost associated with it are just unsustainable. And I think there's a few figures out there. There was something a few years ago, like $2.1 billion or something like that, to bring a drug to market across, you know, 15 years. And of course, accounting for all the failures associated with it. So there has to be this more targeted approach implemented within the research and development pathway. And I think, how do you do that without instilling human fatigue, and how to do that in a way that's efficient, cost efficient, accelerated? I think AI is part of that. AI is part of increasing the data analysis workflow, making that much more efficient. So people could really look at, you know, what are the biomarkers of progression for a particular disease? You know, how do we have to look at these patient cohorts when we design clinical studies? So I don't think it's going to significantly reduce, it's not going to cut in half that timeline, but I think it will still have a significant impact to reducing timelines and certainly reducing the risk on investment for starting those programs.
Huge. I totally agree. What we have now is truly non-sustainable. I make investments in drug development programs, and the risk is immense, as you just correctly alluded, and I quiver every time, but that is the world we're in, and the risk will never go away, of course, but right. This de-risks. I mean, there's almost no chance it doesn't de-risk it some, and for sure, shortening timelines is, in a manner of speaking, one, saving money, but also de-risking. So mm-hmm. I couldn't agree more. I'd like to give you an opportunity to talk about a couple of specific things I read about in your programs. One is called the Unity Platform, and one is called Retina AI Discovery Core. Could you speak to those a little bit about what you guys are doing in those programs?
Yeah, absolutely. So just a little bit of background on Retina AI. We're a global digital company. So we look at taking kind of the power behind digital data and improving workflows, data analysis workflows, whether it's related to research and development for pharma companies, related to improving clinical study workflows, you know, even right down to developing precision medicine tools or clinical decision support tools for pharma companies, ultimately to be used in a clinical setting. So Discovery Unity is actually, it's a data management platform and analysis platform, pretty powerful type of platform, and it's specific to pharma and biotech companies to take data from their clinical studies, upload all of that data into the platform. And this is at scale. So we're talking about hundreds of thousands, you know, right down to some of the projects we've been involved in, millions of data sets, where it's processing that data at scale, looking at biomarkers, looking at endpoints, looking at the whole progression of patient longitudinal data, whether it's related to disease progression or treatment outcomes. So it does this at sort of an unprecedented scale, something that would take years for humans to be involved to do, and to do that relatively quickly. We actually had a chance to do a project with Janssen's R&D group, and we published the poster at ARVO. We looked at 16,000 OCT volumes that they had in the AMD space and managed to process the data, come to some interesting insights in a matter of weeks, versus taking a very, very small subset of that data, 500 OCT volumes, and taking several months, you know, for human graders to go through, do the segmentations for that. So it really does shorten the time frame. You know, in that particular case, it was taking something that would be months, 5 months out, to doing this in a matter of 4 to 6 weeks and coming up with insights on the whole 16,000 OCT volume. So that's really the benefit of what we offer in terms of saving time and money and coming to a conclusion that is in the realm of, you know, 90 to 95% accuracy of what a human grader would do or what human oversight would do. So, you know, being able to apply it at the right stage of kind of doing these, I wouldn't say mundane tasks, but they're tedious tasks in terms of the segmentation across OCT volumes and identifying biomarkers and very important work, but it just takes so much human capital to do that. And human capital being expensive here, why not have AI be the kind of cornerstone to do that and then apply sort of the human capital to more, you know, figuring out what does this mean? You know, what are the target populations that we need to look at? What are the target thresholds that we need to look at? But have the AI that you can trust do sort of all that other sort of early work, if you will, to get to that conclusion. So that's Discovery Unity. And Discovery Core is, it's basically an intro platform that we came out for clinical and academic researchers to have access to AI and be able to, you know, sort of register, have a monthly subscription to it, but they've got a small data set of retrospective data. They want to apply AI, look at layer and fluid segmentation. So they can do that through the Discovery Core platform. And we actually got a lot of interest out of ARVO. It was a good meeting for us to be at in terms of, you know, those clinical and academic researchers, you know, having quick access to AI where readily they wouldn't, they either don't have access to a reading center or access to the expertise to kind of do those segmentations. So it's a great tool for them to have access to that layer, automatic layer and fluid segmentation. And whether they're writing a paper, whether they're just analyzing a small data set, it's a great tool for them to use.
It's amazing. And I don't think you're overselling this at all. In fact, if anything, you're very humble about it. You mentioned a 90 to 95%, you know, let's call it success rate for lack of a better term. I think of fundus photography and grading diabetic retinopathy severity scale, which is very tedious, very manually difficult. And it's a little bit nebulous to most of us, even as practicing physicians. I can't do it. With all due respect to the reading centers who I love and use in all my trials, it seems to me AI would do it. Not, you're using them as the gold standard. And I agree you have to prove the worth of your technology, but I don't see any reason why it wouldn't be better than humans. No, again, no offense meant to my reading center colleagues. They're fabulous and brilliant and put a lot of work into looking at these seven field fundus photographies, which are complicated and counting hemorrhages. Have you used this for, as an example, DRSS grading, or is that something in the cards?
We have actually. We did a study, a multi-center study in Spain, and we looked at over 900 patients were recruited, and the main objective was to validate whether the AI algorithm could appropriately triage these patients, screen these patients for referral. So diabetic patients, you know, were they a candidate for a referral to an ophthalmologist? So we completed that study, I guess it was late last year, published in various forums, Uretina, ARVO, and we're actually submitting to the EMEA an approval. So this was, it wasn't an algorithm that we developed, but it's an algorithm that that runs on our platform. The actual development of it came out of the Fundación Versalud, not-for-profit ophthalmology organization in Spain. And what we found useful by running the algorithm on the Discovery platform was we were collecting other clinical data associated with that diabetic patient, not just the fundus image itself. This is in the cards for submitting to EMEA, as I mentioned. Hopefully by the end of the year, we'll hear back. And then we'll move forward to market that.
I think in things like fundus reading, I'm sure OCT also or other types of technology, it seems to me it'll be better. And you do have to use the doctors as the gold standard for now. But I think as a doctor myself who reads these images, I'm pretty sure artificial intelligence will be better than us at this particular task.
Yeah. And even if it isn't better, and I completely agree with your point. I mean, reading centers are still a staple in clinical studies. It's a validated endpoint, you know, for the FDA, you need a reading center in phase three. But I think in terms of incorporating AI into the reading center model, if the AI can provide kind of that first pass of the segmentations and everything like that, and for the grader to look at those and, you know, scrutinize them and say, okay, this is correct, or this needs some adjustment, you know, based on the data that they're looking at, I think that puts the human grader in a much more efficient position to scrutinize that rather than having to, you know, sort of segment the majority of it. So if the AI can kind of bring that, you know, 90 to 95% of the way, and then, you know, the human expert to look at it and basically have a final sign off on it, I think that's the model to kind of improve, accelerate things and improve the way we do studies, the costs around studies, and, you know, certainly the timelines for approving these drugs too.
Totally logical and makes all the sense in the world to me. You mentioned Janssen, I assume you mean from Johnson & Johnson.
Yes.
If you are able to say so, any other industry or strategic partners that you're having a dialogue with or working with on some of these projects currently?
Yeah, absolutely. So Novartis, we're involved in a phase four clinical study with Novartis. Novartis is a sponsor, but our platform and our AI technology for layer and fluid segmentation is being used in the context of that study. So Razorbill is a open label phase four study in neovascular AMD across four countries in Europe, and Canada is the other country. They are using the platform to analyze OCT images, and they're comparing the AI versus the human reviewer, the ophthalmology reviewer in the evaluation. And the whole objective is whether AI can help optimize treatment by quantifying the endpoints. So we'll be completing that study this summer and hopefully be publishing results, you know, into early next year on that. And there are about 400 patients that are associated with that study. I know there's a few other studies kind of looking at that in the neovascular AMD space. So it's exciting for us to see that there's obviously other groups doing things like this too. And the other collaboration that we've got going on that I could speak about is the Boehringer Ingelheim. So they're using our Unity platform to look at geographic atrophy, data that they have around geographic atrophy, and looking at the various subgroups in that data set. So that's a project that we've kicked off here. And then we're working with other sort of pharmaceutical companies too, both in the area of them using our Discovery Unity platform to do sort of larger scale data analysis, as well as the tools that we have to run clinical studies and help kind of improve the workflow related to data collection, as well as data analysis as part of those studies.
Very exciting. And I am aware of some of the things you talked about, and I'm glad you brought those up. These are great companies, and they're obviously motivated to work with you and bring some of this technology. And I think it's great. This is the kind of collaboration that leads to great products. And which brings me, like, we have a minute left here, to my final point. It's more broad and it's semi-political. Where does this all end up? You know, the clinicians are always worried they're going to get replaced. I'm not, because I'm sort of burnt out. You know, maybe maybe I could stand a little replacement, but I get if I was 35, maybe I'd be wondering, like, hey, am I going to still operate on people? Right. Where do you see this playing out 10 years from now? Are we all going to be using this daily with every patient? This meaning AI as a broad, you know, bucket. What do you, how do you foresee the next 10 years coming around for clinicians?
Yeah, I mean, replacing clinicians? No, I don't see it. And I don't see it in the next 10 years. I don't see it in the next 25 years. There's certainly applications for autonomous AI, and there have been approvals for that. But, you know, that still takes the patient to the next step, where there's a clinician to you know, take images again to treat that patient. So there's always going to be, in my opinion, in the foreseeable future, you know, human oversight. You need that kind of empathetic, you need that way to, you know, maybe have the assistance of AI to look at all those data sets and it's like, okay, what is it really telling us? And have that intuitive nature, kind of that experience, you know, all of that to you know, bring the art back into medicine, so to speak. So I think human oversight is still something we very much need. Just like we make mistakes, machines make mistakes too, models make mistakes too. So I think it's something that we need, but can it help us improve the speed by which we get to decisions and improve the quality of the decisions that we make? Yes, I think that's the area of AI, and that will continue to grow around the healthcare space. And I think that's the part that's really exciting about it is, you know, how to kind of take all these elements that take so much of our time to really kind of have the critical thinking, you know, at the end of the day, have all these things and that have made a conclusion for us and have the critical thinking to say, okay, this is the right thing to do, or no, I'm going to do this and this is my rationale for it. So this is where I think AI can help it, as part of the decision-making process. So
I totally agree. It'll absolutely make us better as clinicians, diagnosticians, as robotics comes along, which I'm also interested in. It'll make us better surgeons. I completely agree. And I think most of us do recognize that, even if a little part of us is fearful and nervous about it. I completely agree. Wow, this was so informative, really, honestly, for me personally, I'm sure for everyone who listens to the program. Natasha Jovic from RetinAI, thank you so much for coming on and really explaining this stuff amazingly. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks, Roz. I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you.